Welcome everyone to another episode of the S80M Rams Ask a Jer podcast series. My name is Hamza Ejaz and I'm your host today. And I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Vicki Noble, who is the Department Chair of Emergency Medicine at Cleveland Medical Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
So let's talk about emergency medicine in terms of what interested you about the specialty in the first place.
Where to begin? There's so many things. I think a lot of us come to emergency medicine because we're generalists and we like a little bit of everything. I think a lot of us come to emergency medicine because we like teams and we like working in a social kind of team-based environment, which I think emergency medicine does to excellence. A lot of us come to emergency medicine because we want to be the person who on the airplane can make the decision and act appropriately and sort of swoop in with the knowledge of a generalist. And I think also a lot of us come to emergency medicine because we like the excitement of unknown. And so I think if you're a person that really likes definitive absolutes, emergency medicine is absolutely not for you. But if you like the puzzle and the figuring things out and how to put all the resources together and how to get this person from point A to point B, there's a lot of things that emergency medicine offers that I think satisfy that need. So I think all of those things were true of me, and so that's why I'm here.
Right on. I think what you mentioned about being comfortable with the unknowns, that sometimes can get lost for the medical students who don't necessarily reflect or think about that aspect of our specialty as much when they're first going through the rotations. You know, for example, we all discharge vague abdominal pains home. We discharge vague chest pains or vague chief complaints in general that we've ruled out the immediate life-threatening illnesses that we worry about. But we still don't 100% understand why their pain or their symptoms to tie it all together. But we have to feel comfortable in that I don't know what's going on. I feel comfortable letting the patient know that, hey, I don't have that answer for you today, but I know it's not X, Y, and Z, and that I've arranged for these X, Y, Z next steps to help you figure out hopefully what's going on. So I do want to echo that that part is really important to our specialty as well in terms of when medical students are considering our specialty to realize that there is a level of unknown and uncertainty with what we do, and we just have to be comfortable with it.
Well, and some of it is the safety net aspect of emergency medicine, because your job is to make sure that people are safe going home. You may not have the answer to all of their problems, and some of it is medical, and some of it is social, some of it is financial, some of it is resources, some of it is access. So there's a lot of things that play into that unknown, but when you kind of profile specialties, that our ability to make decisions with incomplete information and to feel comfortable with not perfect solutions, but almost perfect solutions is something that I think our specialty really trains you for. And the training is the real highlight of emergency medicine, because that leadership, that communication, that advocacy, that decision-making ability is why I think a lot of us are here as chairs, is that, you know, it leads to other leadership positions, because those are the aspects I think that leadership requires in many, many different venues, not just as the leader of your team in the emergency department.
Yeah, so let's dive a little bit deeper into those leadership positions. I noticed that you've previously served as a program director, residency program director.
I've done all the jobs.
Exactly. So let's talk about all the jobs in terms of how did those roles help prepare you to be the chair that you are today?
Well, I think, you know, medicine has a tripartite mission, right? So a lot of us come to leadership because we're awesome researchers, or a lot of us come to leadership because we're really good at operations and sort of finances and economics. There is a third wheel or third, you know, pole or whatever you say that is sometimes forgot, which is education. And I do think the mission of education is something that was really helpful for me in sort of building my leadership skill set. ACGME and program directorship and all the rules around all the science and the thinking about how to best educate residents was something that has really built some of my thinking about how to build a department. Those lessons on how to educate and how to mentor and how to grow residents are the same that I use for my junior faculty and my APPs and my nursing leaders. So I think a lot of those skill sets translate well to chair positions.
Okay, I love that. Now, I also noticed that you're the emergency medicine physician in chief for the entire UH healthcare system. Now, you do that on top of your role as a department chair. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that particular role entails?
Yes, I can. I might have to kill you afterwards.
Uh-oh.
But yeah, no. you know, I think a lot of systems have, we're in a growth phase of hospital systems. And so a lot of systems, not necessarily in the last 3 years, but in the last 10 years, have bought a ton of equipment, practices, community hospitals, you know, critical access hospitals, and brought them into, quote unquote, the system so that they can get the gains from having a big system and having the sort of feeders to their tertiary care centers as well. And I think emergency medicine as an access point for a big system is something that a lot of people have kind of bet on. There is a lot to be gained from having a smooth transition from your community hospital or your critical access hospital to your EMS system and your transfer and your subspecialty surgical services or your ICUs. So a lot of people are putting a lot of effort in that work to streamline the patient flow as they enter your system. And so that's sort of the physician-in-chief job, is to help with that operation and that flow. I think the other job, sort of to go back to the education, is to provide a standard that your brand represents. So when people see the UH Shield or the Rainbow Babies, which is the best pediatric name in medicine, but Rainbow Babies Shield, they know kind of what to expect, and there's a standard, and we do that through quality and through peer review and through education, not just for, again, our residents, but for our faculty and everything. So I think it's a standardization of clinical practice. It's a patient flow mechanism for the system. It's an optimization of right patient, right place, you know, as you have different facilities that you're managing. And I think it's a relatively new job. I don't know many physicians and chiefs 10 years ago, but I think now with the growth of these systems and tertiary care academic centers owning a lot of feeder hospitals, that this has become a more common position.
So. Okay. And how would you contrast that to your role as a department chair, right? Like, it sounds like the physician-in-chief role has a lot of operational streamlining and smoothing processes in terms of replicating what you guys offer at the academic site, a lot of the other hospitals as well. Now, how do you contrast that to what your departmental chair role is?
It's a blurry line, honestly, because a lot of my faculty are faculty at community sites that don't have residents. So, you know, I need to mentor them and make sure their peer review and job satisfaction and all of the rest is at the level that UH expects. I think academic chairs probably have a little bit more of a research bent. There's a little, most programs, although our program is not one of them, don't have a residency in the community and a residency at the academic site. We do. We have two residencies. So I wouldn't say that there's an academic differentiator, because I think that is something we're probably going to talk about with the match, but there are two programs at UH. I think probably the difference between physician in chief and academic chair is one of interfacing with the deans and the med school and more of the research infrastructure of a hospital system, and not so much that you don't do teaching, you don't do mentoring, you don't do faculty development. And honestly, you do research in both spheres, but probably it's a different kind of research. But the lines have gotten very blurry. So I can't probably give you an absolute definition, because they change and these roles are changing week to week, month to month. So
okay. All right. That's very fascinating. It's very unique to see that you can do both of those roles, and you're clearly doing it very well. So that's amazing to hear. You alluded to the match, so let's talk about that. They're recent for the audience. You know, recently there was over 500 unfilled EM residency spots prior to the SOAP. Now there's about 50, I think, unfilled spots after the SOAP. That's over double what had happened the last year, where there's 200 or so unfilled spots prior to the SOAP. How did we get here?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of like chin scratching during this conference and during the CORD conference, which is happening this week as well. I think it's multifactorial, of course, as always. We did add 1,000 residency spots in the last year or two to emergency medicine. And when you add that many spots, I can tell you as a former program director, it's hard to build a really top-notch academic program. It takes some years to get your faculty, to get your curriculum, to get all your learning environments sort of set up. And so maybe we grew too fast, and maybe some of those programs weren't quite ready for 15 interns or 12 interns. We also think the pandemic is going to be blamed, but I don't know that it's a pandemic problem, quite frankly. I think over the last, and I would say even 5 to 7 years, emergency medicine has been the gut with the finger in the dam, like the fairy tale, because there have been increasing signs of boarding, you know, closing hospitals, decreasing EMS services, nurses having change of heart and picking other careers. And, you know, I think one thing we maybe don't acknowledge enough is that I think our specialty was seen by some medical students and some people as a lifestyle specialty for a long time, because it doesn't have call, you know, it is, you don't have your own patient population and you make decent money doing it. But I have always said that we're really like a lifestyle the opposite way, because you do nights and weekends your whole career. You know, you don't sit down many times during your shift because it's just so busy. So I think we maybe mis-messaged some of that, and residents saw it or applicants saw it when they came and did AIs and were like, whoa, this wasn't what I thought. And I think also like that finger in the dam aspect of solving the hospital's problems, like we built OBS units when they couldn't turn around the short stay. We now employ hospitalists, which I just learned at this conference. We now own ambulance services. So we've been fixing problems. But what that does is that diffuses the core values and the core mission of the specialty in terms of medicine. And I think when you have a medical student looking at your specialty, they don't know what it's like to do an ROI and a financial plan for a hospital-based service because, you know, you need 16 extra beds. But they do know what it's like to sit there and watch their attending on a computer and on the phone, and not necessarily what they imagine doing practicing medicine is about. So I think we have a lot of soul searching to do, and there may be a role for residency programs to contract. There may be a role for residency programs to become more focused on the medicine, and then maybe using fellowship or other lines of training to train all the operation stuff, which a lot of us fall into because we're just problem solvers. But I think that doesn't translate to a medical student who's looking for a medical career.
Yeah, and I want you to
thoughts on this. This is a former program director. In the sense that, you know, historically, or not historically, but at least in the last year and part of this year, some of those unfilled spots were through this private equity push towards opening residencies as well. This year, you know, if you look through the soap list, there were respectable emergency medicine academic like shops as well that went unfilled in a few locations as well. How did that happen? You know, like you can understand to some extent that some places are new, therefore the private equity ones that you can maybe understand. But there was also a reasonable number of reputable institutions that also went unfilled.
Well, private equity is not disreputable, so we have to be
careful
in our language. But I think there's two things. One is private equity is filling a need that our academic institutions have failed, which is the critical access rural medicine, small volume emergency departments. And so I think if we kid ourselves that our, you know, big urban training centers at level one trauma centers, those residents are going to go work in rural America. We've missed the point. And the whole point that those private equity residencies came up is because we have not addressed that in our specialty. So I think we reap what we sow in that way. I also think, you know, does any residency class really need 21 interns? I mean, you know, if you look at some of the expansion that's happened at some of our more established programs, they've gone from 12 to 15 to 17 to 20 to 24. Like, if you're training 24 interns, you need resources that we are not providing. And so I think we dilute their experience, we dilute their education, and then we dilute their ability to perform the job well, because they're one of 24, which then means times 3 or 4, they're one of 100. That's a big ask for any program director. I struggled with 10 residents. And so I think we maybe have to look a little harder at how we grant program expansion. I think we also have to look a little harder at, I think the new programs that have developed for a reason. And so if we're not training people to perform emergency medicine in critical access hospitals and they don't want to go there, then maybe we need to rethink who staffs small volume on EDs. And I know there's a lot of controversy about APPs or family medicine, but I think we have proven that we haven't fixed that problem just by expanding the level one trauma center urban core resident number.
And I think a lot of people, when they, you know, the research and this bears out our research as well, where a lot of people who train in these, you know, academic large urban areas end up practicing in a very close radius to that as well. So if you're not necessarily training in a rural area where critical access hospitals are part of your required rotations, then you're probably not going to end up going there.
Well, but that's a great point, because I think we need to mandate that. I think all residents don't know what critical access rural medicine is. And I know Cincinnati does, you know, some rotations up in the UP and things like that, but we need to mandate that, because I don't think we even know who would be interested in it, because they're not even exposed. And I think we need to mandate some of the rural medicine training for all of our programs. I think we also need to think about, you know, in terms of workforce, and I know we're going to get to the workforce report, but the workforce is a moving target, right? And I think if we're thinking about the workforce as staffing level one trauma centers and academic programs where you get buy downs for your interest in, you know, XYZ subspecialty, those positions are probably saturated and tough to come by. But there are jobs upon jobs upon jobs in smaller places, and they can have a rewarding academic teaching, mentoring career. It's just we have to connect those and do a better job at providing the infrastructure to support those places and bring them into the fold. And I think we haven't done that as well as we could have.
Yeah, I think that ties in perfectly to the workforce itself, right? Where the issue is not necessarily as much of a surplus or a shortage. I think it's more of that geographical surplus or shortage. You know, like I'm prior to the pandemic, prior to the report, the very densely populated urban metropolitan areas were probably very difficult job markets to enter anyways. And that probably still holds true to this day. Whereas, you know, a rural area or area with critical access hospitals maybe weren't very difficult to get a job in, and probably still searching for getting, you know, board certified emergency positions there. So let's talk about the workforce here. What are your thoughts there in terms of where do we go?
Well, I think we have a couple things, you know. I've learned a lot being in Ohio from coming from Boston, where we have, you know, 13, if not, I mean, depends on how you count them, but almost 17 hospitals, and many of them are in very low volume EDs. And if you connect people to a mission, right, you connect them to a teaching mission, a peer review mission, a quality mission, you connect them to a faculty development mission or research even at some of these places, they don't think of themselves as like community versus academic. We're all kind of a spectrum, and it's actually really nice for people to pick and choose how much they want to do and what they want to do in terms of their clinical practice. And so I think by, you know, and again, this maybe translates back to the physician in chief thing, but if you have 17 facilities and they're all kind of different in terms of their emphasis on different things, you give faculty an enormous range of opportunities. And I think that is really satisfying. And that's kind of what people are looking for. You know, I think there were generations of emergency physicians who just wanted to, you know, kind of cash it in and worked thousands of hours and wanted to, and there may be those people still. But I think what I've seen is in hiring the new generation of people, they want to feel connected. They want to feel like they're supported. They want to feel like they're learning all the time. They want to feel like they're providing something quality. And so messaging that and developing our systems to give a little more flexibility, so it's not academic versus community, and it's not research versus like just stopping learning after you graduate from residency, why can't we mix that up a little bit and like make it a little more variable and let people participate, you know, at different speeds, at different rates, and also then the residents get to learn from somebody who does a ton of clinical work or, you know, dabbles in things here and there or has some niche of medicine that then they're exposed to. So I think that would go a long way to workforce satisfaction. You know, I think there's a lot of political stuff we do need to advocate in terms of, you know, not for just emergency medicine, but for hospitals in general. You know, we're getting crushed by the, in my feeling, it's not so much private equity, it's the insurance lobby. And, you know, insurance companies made, I think the number is, if you include the top five, like Cigna, United, they made $43 billion last year. Yeah. And hospitals are closing in the United States, so there's money. It's just, it's not going to, you know, the hospitals are being painted as a bad guy, you know? They're too slow, they don't have good staffing, you know, all this other stuff. And somehow somebody is able to siphon off $43 billion, like, to me, there's a smoking gun, but you know, I'm no detective.
that's a fair commentary
yeah.
there for sure. And now I want to take this a little bit of a step back.
Yeah.
You know, you've served as program director, so naturally through that role, I'm sure you've advised many residents in terms of when they go to apply for jobs. What advice would you give to, you know, residents who are listening as they enter the job market now in this current climate?
I think use your networks, right? All of you out there in the world have more advice givers than you know, right? So there's a lot of people in the world of emergency medicine, even though it's grown, is still relatively small. So we all know each other. So if you're focused on a region, ask your attendings, your colleagues, your nurses, you know, everybody who they know in that region so that you can increase your ability to connect with people through that network. If your interest is a subspecialty or a type of medicine, then it's same thing. You know, like use your network to kind of find those people and make those connections. This will be the first time a lot of you have looked for a job in like the real way instead of like the match or, you know, an application. And the real way is humans, connecting humans. And so your references and your peers are the ones that are going to open doors for you in ways that probably in the past it hasn't been as much. So I would say use your connections, use your network. I would say think outside the box. You know, there's a lot more to a job, especially post-residency, than the salary or the location. So think it holistically. You know, there are really great groups with really supportive faculty who may not be in locations that you would think of based on where you've lived before. And so if you are a little more free in terms of geographic destination, I would really think open-mindedly about things because there's a lot of great groups out there. And then finally, I think you want to find a group where you have a invested leader. So making sure that you talk to other faculty when you do your interviews and kind of ask them when was the last time they needed advocacy or when was the last time they needed somebody to kind of fight on the behalf of the group, and figuring out if that cohesiveness and that advocacy is something that people are aware of.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I think that just about wraps up our time for today. Dr. Noble, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
For sharing your insight.
Thanks for doing this. It's been great.
Thank you.